Okay, so our topic for today is called the free market and shareholder rights. And what I want to talk about is more generally the relationship between firms and production and financial markets or capital markets. Okay, for example, we'll talk about the alleged separation of ownership and control, where owners of corporations, shareholders, are supposedly taken advantage of by managers who actually run the corporations. You know, this is, of course, this is big news in recent years with the so-called accounting scandals associated with Enron and WorldCom and Global Crossing and Arthur Andersen. Right, the idea is that executives of large corporations have been systematically misleading their shareholders, taking advantage of shareholders, enriching themselves personally, building houses and buying yachts, you know, while sort of poor mom and pop shareholders, little old ladies who have their retirement savings all in Enron stock or whatever, are being grossly taken advantage of by a corrupt system. So is it the case that shareholders really are at risk under capitalism? Are shareholders really taken advantage of in the free market by unscrupulous managers? Those are the sorts of issues that we want to focus on today. Okay, so let me start with sort of the basic problem as it's typically described. What is the alleged problem separation of ownership and control under capitalism? Well, this falls under the general area of corporate governance or corporate finance, right? So I'll be talking primarily about corporations, although a lot of this applies to any form of business. We'll talk about that as well. But the basic problem, or one of the basic problems of corporate governance, is the following, right? Two well-known authors in the 1930s, named Adolph Burley and Gardner Means, wrote a very famous book called The Modern Corporation and Private Property, published in 1932. The authors were not economists, by the way. Burley, in particular, was a lawyer and a politician, a prominent member of the Roosevelt administration, a sort of a New Deal activist. But what they charged in this book was that capitalism, or modern capitalism, was fatally flawed. They said, well, even if we concede that under sort of primitive capitalism, in a simple society where businesses are small and firms are sort of owner-operated firms, the small corner shop or whatever, maybe we could argue that in seeking to maximize their profits, those managers end up providing goods and services that benefit consumers, right? You know, sort of the standard argument about benefits of capitalism. However, Burley and Means argued, that's no longer true in the modern era in which most production takes place in large corporations. Corporations are owned by shareholders, but run on a day-to-day basis by managers. Right, and they pointed out, quite rightly, that most, at least in the U.S., and in the British system, most shareholders own very small percentages of stock in the company. Right, so shareholding is widely diffused. And so you don't have any single shareholder who has enough, who owns enough stock to exercise effective control. Right, so, you know, if I own a few shares of General Motors, let's say, yes, technically I am an owner. I'm a part owner of GM. But if I just own a few shares, I don't have any voice. I don't have any effective decision rights in how the company is run. Right? So they argued that under modern capitalism, there was a separation between ownership held by small shareholders and control, which was held by managers, salaried managers. And remember, under the corporate structure, even the head of the company, the CEO, the chief executive officer, is an employee, right, is a hired hand of the shareholders. But in practice, we think that the CEO exercises a lot of day-to-day control, and most shareholders are fairly passive and don't attempt to intervene very much in corporate affairs. So according to Burley and Means, we cannot assume that large corporations will produce goods and services in a way that satisfies consumer wants, as we've been arguing all week. Why? Because those who run the corporations, who make the actual decisions about what will be produced and how goods and services will be priced, etc., are running the companies for their own benefit. Right? Managers, such as executives, want high salaries. They want perks. Right? They want a Learjet, and they want a big office with a big desk, and they want paid vacations in the Bahamas and all the rest of it. Right? So what we call this in modern terminology is a principal-agent problem. So there's a principal-agent problem where the agent, the manager, is effectively running the firm for his own benefit at the expense of the principal, the shareholders. Okay, and there's a big modern literature on principal-agent problems, some of which I'll critique a little bit today. Well, what can we say about this? But is it true, in fact, that there is a separation of ownership and control in a modern economy? Well, let me answer this way. It is certainly true that under the corporate system, the owners of firms, shareholders, do delegate the majority of day-to-day control, most of the day-to-day control, to managers. Okay. However, as we touched on a little bit in the lecture on Tuesday on production in the firm, owners always retain some ultimate or residual rights of control. Right? Ownership of assets brings with it certain rights, certain decision rights and control rights that can never truly be delegated, such as the right to decide what is delegated. Okay? I may choose to hire, even if I'm a sole proprietor, I own my own corner, drugstore. I could choose to hire someone to run the store for me as a manager, and then I could just take off. I could go to the beach. I could live, a life of luxury as a playboy, going to casinos or whatever. But I always retain the right to take those decision rights back. Right? I can fire the manager who I hired. I can change my mind about what decision rights the manager gets to have. I can intervene. I can override some decision that the manager makes. The fact that I choose not to intervene on a regular basis does not mean that I have relinquished those rights. It means I've simply chosen not to exercise them. I've chosen to delegate control. So the owner always does retain ultimate control, even if he or she doesn't exercise it on a daily basis. Okay? But we can say more than that. If we start to think through this argument more systematically, we could say something like the following. Yes, it's true that managers do have some de facto control of corporations. However, there are many mechanisms, both internal and external, that limit or control the amount of authority that managers actually have, that place limits on managerial control, that limit the principal-agent problem. Okay, let's go through some of those in detail. And I've divided these into internal and external control mechanisms. Okay, so we'll start with what we might call internal mechanisms, meaning things that happen within the firm or among the firm and its owners. Okay, well, first and most obvious, shareholders, even as a small shareholder, I may not vote on what the corporation's going to do today as opposed to tomorrow, but I can certainly participate in voting for a board of directors, right? And the board of directors is established to review the manager's performance on a regular basis, right? So shareholders can exercise some control through the board of directors. Hey, admittedly an imperfect mechanism, but a mechanism nonetheless. Shareholders can vote on replacing the management team, right? So-called proxy contests, where there is an actual struggle for who will be the top management team. And there's an election, and shareholders can vote on who they want to run the company. Shareholders, typically acting through the board, can also choose to implement some incentive schemes for the managers that will help to align the manager's interests with the shareholder's interests, such as performance-based compensation. So suppose, for example, that the shareholder's objective is to maximize the value of their shares. Pretty reasonable assumption. So assume the shareholders want the stock price of the company to be as high as it can. whereas the managers would prefer something else. The managers want to maximize, say, the size of the firm. That's a typical charge that's leveled against managers. They engage in empire building. You want to be the captain of the biggest ship. So they want to maximize their sales revenue or something like that, or maximize the amount of assets they control, even if that comes at the expense of profitability and stock price. Well, if the owners, the shareholders, are worried about this, they can simply tie the manager's compensation to the stock price of the firm, right? Bonuses based on appreciation and share value, or simply pay the manager in with stock options or with shares directly, right? So make the manager a part owner, thus helping to align the manager's incentives with the shareholder's incentives. Okay, the claim here is not that such incentive schemes work perfectly, but they can be an effective means of disciplining managers' incentive to engage in, you know, malfeasance. Also, we have to remember there's a market for managers itself, right? There's a labor market for managers both inside and outside the firm. What do I mean by that? Well, consider a case where the chief executive officer of the firm is operating the firm, making decisions for his own benefit at the expense of shareholders. And the Burley and Means sort of argument would be, well, the shareholders are very far removed from those operations, so it's very difficult for the shareholders to monitor. They're not really aware of what the CEO is doing because, you know, they're guys like me who just own a few shares here and there. You know, is there anyone who would have an incentive to monitor the CEO and to report any improper behavior to the owners? And the answer is, yeah, other managers who want to be the CEO, right? You know, the lieutenant, other staff in the company, if they see, they're very close to the CEO, and they're aware of what the CEO is doing, and when the CEO is doing something against shareholder wishes, they have an incentive to report to the shareholders, and because they themselves want to be the CEO. You know, think of it as the tattletale theory of corporate governance, or I think of it as sort of the mafia theory. Because if you think about the mafia, of course, with all the Italians we have running around here, we talk about the mafia a lot. Turn that off, Chad. You know, if you think about how a typical Italian crime family works, you know, someone like John Gotti, who was head of the Gambino family, you know, how do you get to be head of a major crime family? Well, typically it's, you know, because you bump off the previous head. You know, you're a lieutenant, you're an underling, and you kill the top guy, and then you become the top guy. Okay, so this kinds of thing happens in firms, hopefully without guns. But there's also managers of other companies, right? I might be an executive in a rival company. I see an opportunity for myself to become the CEO of the company in question. And so I have an incentive to make a case to the shareholders as to why the current CEO is not doing a good job. So the CEO always has to watch his back, so to speak, because others who have knowledge of corporate affairs are in a position to report any bad behavior. Okay, so these are all things that happen typically inside the firm, things that owners can do, the current owners can do, things that other managers can do, not to eliminate, but to limit managerial discretion. There's another set of mechanisms that we might call external control mechanisms that turn out to be typically even more effective than the internal ones. For example, the forces of competition, right? Competition in the product market. So if the firm in question is a computer maker, is Sony making personal computers, if the executives at Sony are engaging in managerial discretion, well, presumably that will show up, that will be reflected in the quality of the product. Right, so if they're taking actions that are not in the shareholders' interests, they're running the firm for their own benefit, well, rival computer makers who are less subject to these problems, will outperform the computer maker in question. Right, so if managers keep running the firm into the ground, eventually it'll go into the ground, it'll go bankrupt. Okay, so there's always competition from rival producers that keep these things in check. Right? There's also potential discipline from suppliers of funds. Okay, we've already talked about the shareholders themselves as suppliers of capital, right? But you might have other large, you might have larger institutional owners who are in a position to exercise more control. Now, we don't have much of this in the U.S. and in the British system for reasons I'll get to a little bit later. There are legal restrictions on ownership of equities by banks, for example. But in many countries, the primary equity holders of corporations are not mom-and-pop shareholders, but are other companies or large institutions, banks, venture funds, etc. Right, in Germany, for example, most corporate stock in Germany is held by large banks. Now, if a large bank owns 50% or 60% of the shares of the stock of your company, well, you can be pretty sure the managers will listen to those bankers when they come to call. Okay, so when you have large influential suppliers of capital, they're in a position and have the incentive to monitor the managers and to take action when the managers are out of line. Okay, but we have another mechanism too, which is maybe the most effective of all, what we call the market for corporate control. The market for corporate control. In other words, the market for the ownership and control of companies themselves. This term, the market for corporate control, was popularized in a famous article in 1965 by Henry Manny called Mergers in the Market for Corporate Control, published in the Journal of Political Economy. Manny made the following argument. He said, well, let's assume that managers are exercising some discretion and they're operating a firm for their own benefit rather than the benefit of shareholders. Well, what will happen to that firm? Well, as managers deviate from shareholder wishes, this will be reflected in lower profitability for the firm, poorer performance for the firm, and eventually a fall in the firm's stock price. Right? As the stock price of the firm falls, what happens? Well, first of all, that provides a signal to outside investors that, hey, something's not quite right in this company. Its stock price is going down, right? Moreover, when the stock price is low, it's much easier for an outside firm, an outside investor, a team of investors, a buyout specialist to come in and simply buy out the shares of the firm in question and take control. In other words, there's a market for the control of the company. An outsider can simply buy up the stock, can make a tender offer to the current shareholders, say, I'll give you X dollars if you'll tender your shares to me, and now I control the company, and I can fire those bad managers, replace them with better managers, and bring the stock price of the firm up. Okay, so managers are always worried about, you know, what we might call a hostile takeover. Okay, it could be a merger. Could be a merger offer from another company. It could be a leveraged buyout, an offer from a so-called corporate raider, a Michael Milken type, who raises cash by selling debt. That's the term leveraged buyout, uses the debt, uses the cash to purchase the shares of the stock and take the firm private, delist it from the exchange, have it as a private company with the goal of, you know, improving things, turning the company around, and then maybe putting it back on the market later. Okay? So, again, the threat of merger or takeover is a powerful limit or check on managerial behavior. Okay? And notice I said the threat of takeover. So it isn't necessary that there actually be a lot of hostile takeovers for this mechanism to be effective. Right? It may be that managers are worried about being taken over, and so to avoid being taken over and fired, they cease doing the value reducing actions and they place more attention on increasing the value of the firm to forestall some kind of a hostile takeover. Okay. It turns out Mises actually has some interesting comments related to the market for corporate control and the relationship more generally between the operations of the firm and what happens in the capital markets. Let me show you a quotation from Mises on the role of capital markets. This is from Human Action. And as I mentioned, in case any of you weren't in the I guess it was on Wednesday, my talk on Wednesday. All these slides are on the web. If you go to the schedule, yeah, so you can click right here, and you can get a PDF version of these slides, so you don't have to write all this stuff down. So Mises says the following. He says, the Burleian means doctrine, the idea that there's a separation from ownership and control and that it leads to inefficiency and harm. He doesn't use the term. He doesn't cite them by name, but this is what he's talking about. The Burleian means doctrine disregards entirely the role that the capital and money market, the stock and bond exchange, which a pertinent idiom simply calls the market, plays in the direction of corporate business. The changes in the prices of common and preferred stock and of corporate bonds are the means applied by the capitalists for the supreme control of the flow of capital. The price structure as determined by speculations on the capital and money markets and on the big commodity exchanges not only decides how much capital is available for the conduct of each corporation's business, it creates a state of affairs to which the managers must adjust their operations in detail. Okay, notice the financial markets not only decide how much capital is available for the conduct of each corporation's business, it also creates a state of affairs, an environment, to which the manager must adjust his operations. What does he mean? Well, he means it's the financial markets that decide how much capital that manager has to play with in the first place. Okay, to expand his operations, to be captain of a bigger ship, the manager has to go to the capital markets for funds by selling debt or issuing stock or whatever. And financial market participants, by setting the firm's cost of capital, by their willingness to extend capital or not to the firm, place a constraint on the manager's ability to expand. Okay, the fact that the shares of the firm are themselves tradable creates an environment into which the manager has to adjust his operations. The manager has to take this into account. There's a point here, something that I mentioned on Tuesday. One of the problems with the neoclassical theory of the firm is that it's told exclusively from the point of view of the manager. You know, the manager of a plant, let's say, who has the task of, you know, choosing the level of output such that marginal revenue is equal to marginal cost and all that. Right? The question of how much capital the firm has, right? Can the firm expand its operations through capital investment is completely ignored. Okay? You know, who decided there would be a firm there in the first place? Who decided how much capital this manager would have to work with in setting MR equal to MC? That's completely outside the theory, right? Where in fact, as Mises points out, the real action is at the investor level. The investors decide what firms will be in existence, what production facilities will exist, how many resources those plant managers will have to work with, and then the plant managers can go and make their output decision. But that's a second order decision relative to the real question of how capital will be allocated in a market economy. Okay, come back to that point in just a second. Mises does not explicitly mention the role of the takeover market, as in Manny's piece, but it's clear from the clear message from Mises is that it's sort of the most important market, you could say. Excuse me. The real action in a capitalist economy is not necessarily in the product market or in the labor market, but really in the financial market or the capital market. Okay, it's the stock market, the bond market, the equity markets, where the most important decisions about resource allocation are made. Rothbard relates an anecdote about something that happened in Mises' seminar at NYU. They were studying socialism and interventionism, and a student asked Mises the following question. Well, we've studied pure capitalism and how it would work, and we've studied pure socialism and how it would work. But, you know, we know that if we look out into the real world, there are no economies that are 100% capitalist or 100% socialist. Right? There's always some mixture, right? You either have sort of, you know, capitalist economies with greater or lesser degrees of government intervention, or even in a nominally socialist economy, you have some markets, black markets, and so on. So, you know, it's kind of a continuum with sort of a big gray area in the middle. And the question was, you know, Professor Mises, is there any way to sort of draw a line and say, okay, on this side of the line, you're capitalist, even if you have some intervention. On this side of the line, you're socialist, even if you have some markets. And the expectation was that Mises would say, no, you know, it's just sort of a continuum. You know, you just have to arbitrarily assign them here or there. But no, Mises answered, yes, there is a criterion for distinguishing between capitalism and socialism, and that's whether the economy has a stock market. He said, if that society has a stock market, no matter how socialistic it may be, it is essentially a capitalist economy with a lot of government intervention. Right? No matter how many markets, labor markets or product markets or black markets, an economy may have, if it doesn't have a stock market, either formal or informal, then it's a socialist economy. Okay, so the presence of a stock market is, for Mises, the defining characteristic of a capitalist economy. Right? That suggests that to us as economists, we really should take seriously and should study the role that the financial markets have and not treat them as just sort of an add-on, an afterthought, as is often the case in some neoclassical models, right, where the action is at the plant production level, and yeah, the manager can go to the capital markets and get as much capital as he wants at, you know, at the market price, and it's just sort of a trivial issue. No, that's where the real action is, according to Mises. It turns out that the role of the financial markets is also key to Mises' sort of last word on socialism that's in Human Action. Right? If you remember the story, Mises first makes his case about socialist economic calculation in the 1920s, in his 1920 article and his 1922 book. And then this so-called socialist calculation debate goes on back and forth, and other people jump into the fray. There was this, Hayek and Robbins had added in the 1930s the argument that socialism was impossible because of dispersed knowledge, that socialist planners would not have all the necessary knowledge to make good decisions. And then a set of socialist economists, for example, Oscar Lange, well-known Polish economist, Abba Lerner, who was at the LSE, came up with a model of what they called market socialism, sort of a hybrid of socialism and capitalism, which they claimed would work and would overcome the problems raised by Mises and Hayek. And they said, well, essentially what you do is, you know, the government owns all the means of production, so the government owns all the factories, all the capital stock, but what we do is we kind of mimic capitalism in the following way. We set up these plants and we put managers in charge of the plants and we tell the managers, okay, we want you to produce where marginal revenue is equal to marginal cost. Okay, how do they do that? Well, we start with just sort of an arbitrary level of production. Managers can produce goods and services, and then we sort of see what happens in the product market. You know, if there's a surplus, then they lower the price. If there's a shortage, they raise the price or whatever. And so essentially we have the managers mimic what the managers of private corporations would do. And we end up with basically the same thing, right? Instead of having actual capitalism, why don't we just have kind of pretend capitalism? We have socialist ownership, but we instruct the socialist managers to act like capitalist managers. Well, Mises actually has a brief but important response to the market socialists that's in a section of Human Action, which has received relatively little attention even from Austrian economists who assume that sort of seem to think that Mises said all he wanted to say, you know, in the 1920s and never really came back to the subject. But no, in his description of the calculation problem in 1949, he doesn't just reiterate his arguments from the 20s, he adds some new ones as well. And he explicitly critiques the market socialists. And he says, well, the market socialists missed the point because, like the neoclassical economists I mentioned before, they focus at the level of the manager, not the owner. And Mises has some really pregnant remarks about what he calls playing market. He says you cannot have people play market like it's a game, you know, like it's a game of Monopoly or something. Okay? Mises says, look, even if you could have managers and you could tell them to play a little game where they adjust their production up or down depending on certain information that they receive, what you cannot possibly replicate is, you know, playing capital market. Mises says, even if you could play product market, you can't play capital market. Or what he says is, it's impossible to play speculator and investor. Okay, because real speculators and real investors are investing real money. They're putting real dollars at stake, their own resources, which can never be simulated or replicated through some kind of artificial system. Okay. He says the problem is that the market socialists see everything from the point of view of the plant manager, not from the point of view of the entrepreneur or the investor. They don't take seriously the role of financial markets. Right? So even some kind of a hybrid quasi-market, quasi-socialist system, a system like that would not be able to perform economic calculation if there is no private market for capital assets, if there is no stock market. Okay? I mean, if you think about the principal agent problem, the way the situation is portrayed in contemporary literature, I think one of the drawbacks, one of the confusions in agency theory is that agency theory views everything from the point of view of the agent. Or rather, the problem is, you know, assume the principal knows what he or she wants to have done. How do you get the agent to do what you want? Okay, you know, incentive problem. How do you align the agent's interests with yours? But there's another problem, right? How does the principal know what he or she wants to do? Okay, what tasks should be performed in a market economy? Which firms with their little principal agent problems inside should even exist in the first place? Right? The most important function that a capitalist economy performs in Mises' terms is not so much how to produce efficiently given that you have a plant in place, but how to allocate capital among the various branches of industry in society. Right? How much capital goes to automobiles as opposed to computers, as opposed to agriculture or whatever. That's the task that even the market socialists have not addressed. That's the fundamental task, the most important task performed under capitalism that cannot be replicated in any kind of socialist system. Okay. By the way, there's a point that Rothbard has made, going back to this MR equals MC business, that he says one of the problems, he says it's silly to assume that, okay, here's a firm, here's a plant, and the manager is going to push production out to the point where you squeeze out every last cent of profit on units produced and marginal revenue equals marginal cost, because that ignores the opportunity cost of producing those units. Right? What if the resources used to produce the nth unit could have been invested in some other line of production? Well, that option is not available to the manager in a standard neoclassical production function problem, right? The option of shutting the plant down or taking some of the capital and liquidating it and investing it somewhere else is not, that's not an option. Okay, we put you in a plant and we tell you can control, you can set quantity. That's pretty much all you can do. Now go maximize profits. Well, I mean, in fact, right, what an investor tries to maximize is not the level of profit, right, but some kind of return on investment, right? It's how much profit I get relative to the amount of capital I have invested in this business. And if the rate of return is low in this business, I'm going to take my money out and invest it somewhere else. And so we might not always have firms maximizing their level of money profit. No, instead you have investors maximizing the return on their equity, the return on their investment. That's a different problem from the one that's portrayed in the typical intermediate micro text. Okay? Now, let's talk about the market for corporate control itself. Does it actually work? Well, there are a lot of mainstream economists and policy critics or whatever who will say, okay, we see the point. We understand that the market for corporate control could in principle, work to alleviate agency problems, to alleviate the Burleian means problem. But we don't think it works very well. We don't think the market for corporate control is really very efficient, using the term efficiency, efficient loosely here. Okay. Some of the criticisms that they offer are the following. Well, on the one hand, they say, the threat of being taken over by another firm could discipline a power-hungry manager, but doesn't it also enable managers to build their empires because they can take over other firms? Right? The manager who's seeking status and power and prestige against the wishes of his shareholders, if there's an active market for corporate control, can't the bad managers use that to take over other firms? Right? So how do we know that the firm that's doing the taking over is in fact going to restore, you know, efficiency to the system? What if that's just making the problem worse? Doesn't the takeover market facilitate what we might call empire building? Isn't it the case that a lot of inefficient companies grow large through making acquisitions? Right? This charge is particularly leveled against firms that make acquisitions by stock swap, right? Paying with their own stock rather than paying with cash. Well, there are some things that we can say about this empire building critique. Right? I mean, first, the main point is it misses the fundamental idea that, right, as long as there's competition in that market for corporate control, a firm that is a poorly run firm that is expanding by taking over other firms itself becomes a very attractive takeover target for a private equity company or for a well-run firm or for a private investor. Okay, as long as investors are free to buy and sell shares, right, a firm that's expanding, a manager who's building an empire by taking over other firms, he cannot control the price of his stock. That's controlled by investors. That's controlled in the stock market. Right? And in fact, you see, if you look at the literature on, you know, evaluating merger performance, when Company A announces that it's going to acquire Company B, as often as not, the share price of Company A falls rather than rises. Right, investors often show their disapproval of an acquisition early on, so it's not the case that managers can avoid being disciplined by capital markets by making a bunch of takeovers. Okay, that may put them in a worse position for being disciplined. Okay, and actually there is some empirical literature on this. There's a very interesting paper by Kenneth Lane, LEHN, called "Do Bad Bidders Make Good Targets?" They do an empirical study of firms with poor performance that actually go out and make tender offers for other firms and find that those bad bidders themselves are more likely than other firms to be the subject of a takeover attempt later. Okay, so there's some evidence that it actually does that work that way in the stock market. Okay, now, in contrast to this, some critics make sort of the opposite claim. They say, well, in fact, the problem is not that there are too many takeovers. The problem is that there are too few. I'm actually looking to see if I have a whiteboard. It's going to do a numerical example. Well, the story goes something like this. Okay, suppose that you have a company that is where there's a, you know, big Burleian means problem, company that's being run poorly. Suppose that the shares are currently trading at, say, $8 a share. Okay, so the market price of this company, $8 a share, and let's say there's 1,000 shares outstanding. So suppose that, you know, a corporate raider, an investor, can come in and buy out that firm for $8,000. Okay, suppose the investor, the raider, why would the raider do that? Well, he believes that he can take over the firm for $8,000 and he can, you know, kick out the poorly performing managers and install a new management team, make the firm perform better, and then boost the stock price up to, say, $10 a share. So the corporate raider, the takeover specialist, thinks, you know, the true value of the firm is $10,000. But he can currently buy it for $8,000 because the stock price is depressed, right? So he goes to the shareholders and says, hey, I'll give you $8 if you'll turn over your shares. Let me say the shares are currently trading at, you know, $6. So a shareholder would say, well, yeah, this thing's only worth $6. You're offering me $8. Yeah, of course. Here you go. You can have it. Right. So by paying some premium over the current market value of the shares, but less than what the raider thinks the shares will eventually be worth, the raider can make some money, right? Can buy control of the company, turn things around, then sell it later and earn a nice tidy profit. Well, the critics say, some modern theorists have said, but wait. If I'm a shareholder, right, and I'm holding shares that are currently trading, say, at $6 a share, and here comes a corporate raider offering me $8 to tender my shares. If I'm smart, I'm thinking, well, wait a minute. Why would he be offering me $8 for my shares that are only trading at $6? It must be because he thinks he can make them worth more than $8. Right? So if I'm smart, I'm going to hold on to my shares. I'll refuse to tender, hoping that enough other shareholders will tender at $8 a share, that the raider will be able to acquire control, and then we'll turn around the company and the shares will rise to $10 a share, and I'll still have mine. Right? In other words, the smart shareholder will want to free ride on the actions of the other shareholders, will want to hold on to his shares. Right? So if this final, you know, sort of equilibrium value of $10 a share is common knowledge, if everybody knows that the ultimate price of these shares will be $10 a share, then no shareholder would be willing to sell for anything less than $10. Right? Therefore, the raider cannot make any money doing this. Right? If no one will tender his shares for anything less than the ultimate long-run price of the company, then the raider has no incentive to try to turn this company around because it can't make any money. Okay, therefore, these critics say, in equilibrium, there won't be any of these disciplinary takeovers. Because of the free rider problem, no raiders will, in fact, be able to take over companies and correct the problems. Okay, well, I mean, there are many problems with this free rider argument, but the most important of which I hope maybe you picked up in the way I described the problem. It assumes that the post-takeover value of the shares is common knowledge, is known to everyone, right? That investors, the smart investor knows that the share will eventually be worth $10 a share. So gosh, I'm not going to sell. Right? But in fact, remember, the raider is offering you $8 a share now. That's money in hand, right? The post-takeover value of the firm is something that is realized only in the future, and it's uncertain. Right? I mean, nobody knows for sure whether the raider will be successful in turning around the company. Maybe the turnaround attempt will be a failure, and rather than rising to $10 a share, the shares will sink to $2 a share. Okay? The whole thing may not work. In other words, what is the raider doing? The raider who successfully buys out the shares at a lower price and then turns around the company and in the future sells the shares at a higher price has just earned some entrepreneurial profit. Right? The raider is an entrepreneur in the Misesian sense of bearing uncertainty. The entrepreneur is buying something in the present, the shares that I can get now, in anticipation of having product to sell in the future, the higher valued shares. In other words, the raider is taking a gamble. And not all shareholders may be willing to bear that uncertainty. I mean, I might rather have the $8 now than the possibility of maybe having 10 or 2 later. Okay, so as long as market participants differ in their expectations of future prices, as long as they differ in their willingness and ability to bear uncertainty, there will be profit opportunities for entrepreneur raiders. Okay, or raider entrepreneurs, let's call them. Right, so outside of the evenly rotating economy, outside of the ERE, there will be profit opportunities for raiders. Okay, question?
Isn't this that free rider problem kind of a silly idea anyway? Because, I mean, if you're presuming all this knowledge, then the shareholders are going to know that nobody's going to sell and that the raider isn't going to be able to buy it. So then on the other hand, they'd be like, okay, well, nobody else is going to, and it's not going to work anyway. I might as well. So, I mean, the thing falls under its own weight.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a good point. Okay, so let me make a couple of other comments and then open it up for some more general questions. Excuse me, just one second. Okay, couldn't remember if this was the last slide or the next to last. Okay, it's the next to last. Oh, goody. So there's some other interesting points that Mises makes along these lines. I strongly recommend, if you haven't read it, Mises' little book called Bureaucracy. It was published in the 1940s. It's short, and I think it's excellent. It contains a very clear, concise statement of the socialist calculation problem. Mises also has some similar passages in Human Action, distinguishing what he calls bureaucratic management from profit management. What he means by bureaucratic management is management by rule, by formal rule and procedure, rather than management with greater decentralization, where managers have some latitude to use the knowledge that they have to make decisions. So Mises points out that, you know, some critics look at the corporation and they say, oh, well, corporations don't seem very responsive to consumer wishes. They seem to be static and rigid in some of their procedures. They seem to be, you know, bureaucratic, quote unquote. Isn't that a defect of capitalism? And Mises says, no, a lot of these problems are actually the result of government intervention into corporate affairs, right? For example, you know, taxes and regulations that distort or limit profits, the profit signals, right? Remember our whole story, our Henry Manny story, was that when the managers perform poorly, the profitability of the firm falls, that the share price of the firm also falls, that provides an incentive opportunity for someone to come take over the firm, et cetera, et cetera. Right, well, you know, if we're talking about a, you know, regulated public utility, where profits are set by some formula, are set according to some formula by a rate board, well then, you know, the managers can be doing whatever the heck they want, and those profit signals are not going to be there. Okay. Taxes on corporate profits limit this flow of information and so on. Mises refers to laws that interfere with hiring and firing, okay, distort entrepreneurs' ability to control their managers using the internal and external control mechanisms we've described. The threat of arbitrary antitrust or regulatory activity, right, the fear of not knowing what's coming down the pike, creates problems for entrepreneurs in making decisions about their relationships with managers. Mises has a quote in Bureaucracy, so something like, you know, this system forces the entrepreneur to become an expert in bribery and diplomacy. Okay, so all the resources that go into lobbying, into trying to figure out what regulations are coming down the road, trying to interpret and implement regulations. I mean, my goodness, look at the Sarbanes-Oxley rules in the U.S. There have been estimates of, you know, how much companies are spending to try to comply with these new accounting requirements. It's a huge misallocation of resources. We might also think of other government forms of government intervention, ones that Mises doesn't talk about but could be added to this list, such as restrictions on institutional ownership. I mentioned earlier this point about banks owning equities and how you have that in some systems, Germany, Japan, for example. We don't have it in the U.S. or in the U.K. It's an interesting book by Mark Rowe, who's a professor at Harvard Law School, has done a lot of work in this area, and has a well-known book called Strong Managers, Weak Owners. I think it came out in 1990. Strong Managers, Weak Owners. He argues that the reason for this alleged separation of ownership and control in the U.S. and the U.K. is because government regulations prohibit banks from owning shares, that we've artificially restricted the role of banks. The Glass-Steagall Act and other Depression-era restrictions on banks prohibit them from playing an active role in corporate governance. Right? That Rowe's argument implies that in the absence of such regulation, in a free market, we would actually have a lot more institutional ownership. We wouldn't have this widely dispersed, highly fragmented or fractured ownership, that that itself is an artificial creation of government intervention. It's interesting, worth taking a look at. We could also point to federal and particularly state level anti-takeover laws, right? I mean, you can imagine, if you think about the process of a so-called hostile takeover, right? Well, powerful, politically connected executives who don't wish to lose their jobs, will lobby their friends in government to have rules passed that make it harder to take over companies, right? And we have all these rules now that if you're a so-called raider, if you acquire more than some threshold amount, 5%, maybe 8% of the shares of a company, you have to formally disclose your intentions. And there's a waiting period, a 30-day, a 45-day waiting period. So you can't just go in and buy out all the shares of the company overnight. You have to disclose your intentions ahead of time. Well, of course, what this does is give the incumbent managers time to prepare an anti-takeover defense, to figure out what to do to keep from losing their jobs. Right? It's an early warning system for inefficient managers who, of course, have lobbied heavily for such rules, such restrictions to be in place. Okay, so just kind of to summarize the general argument that we're talking about here, is it the case that we need government, that we need regulatory bodies to protect shareholders, to preserve the rights of shareholders in a market system, to protect shareholders from unscrupulous managers and so on? Well, remember, this is really a subset of a more general problem, more general question about government regulation. This is really part of the issue of government regulation of safety or quality, like with food or drugs. People say, well, if we didn't have the Food and Drug Administration in the U.S., then the supermarket would have, tainted meat on the shelf, and pharmaceutical companies would produce, killer aspirin. We would have unsafe products for sale if we didn't have an oversight agency, the FDA, to test and make sure that everything that's offered for sale is safe. Right? The same argument applies here. People say, well, if we didn't have the Securities and Exchange Commission and other financial market regulators, then firms would have unsafe stock for sale on the stock market. Right? We have to have a supervisor to protect shareholders from low-quality stock, just as we need a supervisor to protect food consumers from low-quality food. Okay? And I'm not going to repeat them here, because I'm sure many of you are familiar with these kinds of arguments and know some of the good counter-arguments in the case of the FDA or whatever. Well, the exact same thing would apply to the SEC. Again, this idea that even in the absence of the FDA, it wouldn't be in the interest of a company with a brand name, like Bayer or something, to put killer aspirin on the shelves, right? Because that would hurt the value of the brand. In the absence of the FDA, you would have a lot more emphasis on brand names rather than on generics. Right, and it's in the interest of the owner of a brand to try to preserve the value of the brand by monitoring safety and quality, him or herself. Right, and the same applies here. There are plenty of examples of companies that have made bad decisions, that have had to make corrections to their accounting statements, not because government regulators figured out that something was wrong, but because other market participants questioned the accounting statements, the financial statements, and the firms were forced by investors to restate their earnings or to correct the misinformation or whatever. Okay? It's this idea that you can't fool all of the people all of the time. Right? I mean, just as there are some food consumers who don't pay particular attention to what they eat, there are some investors who don't pay particular attention to what they own. But that isn't the case for all investors. Right? Even in a purely free system, in a free market system, it would not be the case that a company can systematically distort its earnings, can issue fraudulent accounting statements, because this would be discovered by investors, and investors would punish the malfeasance by bidding the price of the stock down. Okay, we could also add a whole bunch of negative consequences of regulation. right? I mean, it's like this argument you might have heard people talk about government failure as to go along with so-called market failure, right? So going back to drugs, you know, even if someone conceded, well, gosh, yeah, without the FDA, there might be bad drugs offered for sale, and this would hurt people. But the FDA does a lot of bad stuff too, right? I mean, it keeps potentially life-preserving drugs off the market until they've been tested for 5 years. And I think Hans Hoppe mentioned this the other night, or someone did, that, you know, if I'm a cancer patient, I might be willing to try some experimental drug, even if the risk is high, even if it hasn't been thoroughly tested, and the FDA won't allow me to do so. Right? So think about how regulatory agencies work and all the harm that they do. I mean, two of my least favorite public officials, Rudy Giuliani and Elliot Spitzer. Giuliani was the district attorney in New York during the 1980s when Michael Milken and Ivan Boesky and people like that were put in prison. And Elliot Spitzer is the one who's going after Enron and going after he's head of the sort of corporate scandal enforcement movement today. And I mean, look at Rudy Giuliani. A lot of these guys, why are they doing this? Well, they're self-aggrandizement, right? It's building their own fame and reputation in the market so, you know, Giuliani can be president in 2008. You know, Elliot Spitzer is sort of a charismatic Giuliani clone who has higher political aspiration himself. Anyway, the point is, even if you believed that it were possible in principle to have some government regulatory agency that could, monitor stock markets, well, you provide there's the danger that some opportunistic attorney general, state attorney general, like these guys, would take advantage of that and use it as a way to gain fame and fortune and prestige for him or herself. So we could go through individual securities laws and talk about problems with them. Right, so, you know, the bottom line here is that if you think about these scandals that have been in the news, you know, Enron, for example, you know, what actually happened in the Enron case is very interesting. It isn't the case that some intrepid government whistleblower found out that Enron was engaged in some funny business and made this public. You know, the reason that government regulators first began to investigate Enron was because of a sudden fall in Enron stock price. Right? Now, what does that tell you about who knew what? It tells you that the investment community had already figured out that something was wrong, right? Investors, having discovered that some things about Enron's accounting didn't seem right, were selling their shares like mad. It was the fall in the stock price that alerted the government regulators to do, you know, that something was up, and then they went in and started acting. So they came to the party after it was already over, okay? So the point is, even in the absence of these regulators, you know, there's a tendency for malfeasance to be discovered and punished by those who have skin in the game, who have money at stake, namely capitalist entrepreneur speculators. Okay. It's 10 o'clock, but I'd be happy to take one or two and then to chat during the break. In the back, yes.
I'm a little less sanguine about management than you are, having been this quarter for the last several years. I do happen to believe the scene is managerialism, and that there is precious little difference between what corporations, particularly large ones, are managed, and government is managed. By the number of senior corporate managers who switch from government to corporations and back again, particularly in Republican administrations, but also in Democratic ones. Aside. I also think that it's important to note just how destructive quarterly reporting is. You mentioned the SEC, but quarterly reporting, particularly in the last year, that just creates a tremendous negative incentive for short-termism, particularly for managers.
Yeah. Sure.
That it is not a particularly efficient process to disseminate information.
Right. But let me just comment briefly on both of those points. Right. On your first point, remember, there's always a fundamental difference between a corporation and a government agency in the sense that a corporation is in competition with other corporations. Right. So no matter how large and bureaucratic, you know, IBM or General Motors may be, right? In a purely free society, they would always be constrained by the actions of other companies, by the actions of investors. So, you know, it would be up to firms to choose how much discretion they want to delegate to managers, how rigid they want their procedures to be. But on your point about people switching back and forth, it's a very good point, but that's not, I don't interpret that as a criticism of the corporate form per se, right, but of the highly regulated economy in which we live, under which, hey, you know, if you're an airplane manufacturer, or if you're in the defense business, well, gosh, if you don't have some former generals and congressmen on your payroll, you're never going to get any procurement contracts. So I view that as a consequence of the regulatory state, right? That you have to have some politicians on your board to be able to get by. In the absence of politicians, we wouldn't have that problem. There's an old saying about, Mark's giving me the, we'll take one more question. Let me just make, there's an old saying about lobbying that when politicians control buying and selling, the first thing to be bought and sold will be politicians.
Well, are you stating is that there isn't a principal and agent problem, but mainly that the owners, the shareholders, aren't doing well for the job as owners?
I couldn't hear the second part. Say it again louder.
What are you stating is that there isn't a principal and agent problem, but that the shareholders, the owners, the principals, aren't doing well their job as owners?
Yeah, I guess, right, what I'm saying is, if the problem is that, two ways to look at it, right, that if the problem is that agents are deviating from principals' wishes, then yeah, I mean, I think it's fair to call that a distortion, an error, an inefficiency.
By the shareholders.
Yeah, but the point is, the shareholders can choose to invest in however much monitoring they want. And if the shareholder thinks that, well, yes, I know that my agent is getting away with a little bit of stuff that I don't want, but it's not worth my time and effort to police it. You know, I know that my employees are, you know, taking paper clips home with them at night. It's not worth setting up an expensive monitoring system to stop that because the costs are low. So the point is, the principal can choose how much discretion to let the agent get away with. Okay, I'm sorry we went over time, but...